This is The New Criterion. I'm James Panero, Executive Editor. If you caught our last podcast with Ben Reilly, you will know that this season at the magazine we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of our Hilton Kramer Fellowship. The HK Fellowship honors the life and career of our founding editor, Hilton Kramer, by giving a recent college graduate the chance to join our editorial staff and apprentice as a culture critic here for 1 year. We have now welcomed 10 fellows as colleagues at the publication. Our fellows have gone on to appointments at the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, City Journal, and the American Spectator. Several of them have joined our own ranks here as full-time editors. Our editorial staff is now made up of a majority of HK alumni. So this season, we are celebrating this achievement with a series of podcasts with our fellows. For our second guest of the series, again, we didn't have to look far, the 2019-20 HK Fellow, Robert Erickson, is now Associate Editor of The New Criterion. Rob, thanks for being here today.
Thanks. Glad to be joining.
Rob is a graduate of Middlebury College, where he majored in classics and the program in literary studies. He taught for a year at a charter school in the South Bronx before becoming our 7th HK Fellow. He then went on to read classics at Columbia University and to study as a Claremont Publius Fellow before rejoining our ranks in 2021. Now, we work in an office of classics majors, but Rob was the one to start up a classics reading group for the staff upon his return. A year ago, we recorded a podcast together just as we were getting underway with the histories of Herodotus. Now we are on to books 7 and 8 of Virgil's Aeneid. Here's a snippet of one afternoon a few months back as we read from the funeral oration of Thucydides.
We are unique in considering the man who takes no part in public affairs. This is Bottom 93. For those of you who do have it, not apolitical, but useless, and we ourselves either ratify or even propound successful policies, finding harm not in the effect of speeches on action, but in failing to get instruction by speech before proceeding to what must be done. For in that we are both especially daring, and this is a part I don't want to lie in mind, both especially daring and especially thorough in calculating what we attempt, we can truly be distinguished from other men, for whom ignorance is boldness, but calculation brings hesitancy. So we're talking about for Themistocles, you know, is this idea of kind of double dealing, calculation, is this somehow opposed to virtue? Well, you know, according to this funeral speech of Pericles, no, these things coexist. Boldness and calculation exist together in the Athenians, whereas for most men, you know, calculation brings hesitancy. Rightly would they be judged strongest in spirit who recognize both dangers and pleasures with utmost clarity and are on neither count deterred from risks.
Rob, I wonder if you could take our listeners through some of the stopovers of your curriculum.
Sure, yes. Curriculum is putting it grandly, but we have been doing a bit of a grand tour of ancient Greece and Rome. We've been hitting some of the big grand narratives. We started with Herodotus. We've also done Ovid's Metamorphoses, which, you know, traces the history of the world from its beginning times down to our present day, as the poet says. And now we're on Virgil's Aeneid, which is, of course, great fun and deeply, deeply moving poetry as well. But we've also had some stops with some smaller works, though not necessarily less major or less important. One would be Hesiod's Works and Days in his Theogony. The other was with Plutarch's Lives, his compendium of morals and virtue. And so we spent a lot of time with those very fun pairings of Greek and Roman great men of history.
And it's about every 2 weeks, some afternoon?
Every 2 weeks, if we're lucky, every week. We try to get as many around the table as we can. And that's what's turned out to be the most important to keeping this little project alive is having the same group that can come in every week and pick out some of these threads that are running through the classical world you wouldn't necessarily think to jump from Herodotus to Ovid or from Hesiod to Virgil directly, but when you do, in fact, there are some parallels that are very striking, and it makes the appreciation, whether it's your first time coming to the classics or you're coming back to them, you know, for the 10th time, makes your appreciation all the greater.
And these works are all, we're reading them all in translation. And listeners, what we'll do is we'll post the list of books that we're using to the podcast posting, so you can see the list there if they're interested in checking it out. I wonder if our listeners wanted to create their own classics reading group, any resources you'd recommend? Aside from yourself. Well, let me ask this. What did you draw on in creating this? Did you take a survey yourself as an undergraduate?
One of the great things about the classics, in my view, and some people would disagree with this, is that you really can start almost anywhere if you're thoughtful about the way that you move through. Some people will say that to get, you know, an appreciation of classical history, you need to start first with Plato, and then read everything from classical Greece. So that would be, you know, Herodotus, Thucydides, all the dramatists. And then once you've exhausted all of that, you can move forward to the Roman world. And there's particular orders in which you have to read everything. I don't quite buy into that so much. There are major lights that you know need to be on any serious curriculum, if we're going to use that word again. Obviously, the great epic poems, Homer's Odyssey and Iliad, the Aeneid needs to be, you know, on any sort of survey. It's good to have Plato. That was actually what we started with in the reading group back before the pandemic, back in, I think that would have been the spring, February of 2020, and those final days of freedom. We started with the Republic, Aristotle, but there are just so many different directions to go, and so many ways to approach it. So I think the key is finding a good translation.
Finding a group,
yeah. Finding a good translation, finding a group, and
just going for it, right?
At a certain point, it really does come down to simply going for it. There's a wealth of information out there on the classics. Oxford, for instance, has wonderful resources, classical bibliographies. But, you know, the biggest barrier, I think, in a lot of cases is this impression we have. The classics are, you know, somehow incomprehensible to us, or they need to be kind of translated or toned down. And if you're not armed with, you know, a whole bevy of footnotes and supplementary materials, you won't have any hope of understanding.
Sure.
And that can be true of the more, say, esoteric verses of Pindar or arcane philosophers, pre-Socratic philosophers, for instance. But really, for the most part, with the very capable and often very excellent translations that are on the market today, in my view, one gets a greater appreciation for these works simply by consuming them really in one big gulp. Taking Virgil and not necessarily saying, hey, I'm going to read one book a month, or, you know, try to imitate his pace of publication. The story goes that Virgil spent 10 years working on the Aeneid, which I think if you work it out, comes out to something like 3 lines a day. Not to take it so slowly, but really to digest it all at once, give it a whole pass, read the whole thing.
We tend to do 2 books at once.
As fast as you can, and get through it, because that's the only way you can really kind of see the grand vision, kind of the overarching spirit of the work. If you're reading, you know, excerpts from Herodotus, for instance, you don't really understand the entire spirit of his inquiry, right? That's the very title of the work, his history, his inquiry. You don't really appreciate what his sojourns into Egypt have to do with the battle between Xerxes and the Greeks if you kind of haven't read it all at once. So for, you know, coming to the works for the first time, a lot of I think beginners can get kind of bogged down in footnotes and worrying about not understanding every little thing. The important thing is just to pick up and start reading.
I mean, in addition to you being our great Virgil, I would also say these new translations, some of them are quite good, and they're much more accessible than some of the older, somewhat fusty translations we might have grown up with.
They are, that's right. So for the Metamorphoses, we use Charles Martin's translation, excellent translation. He also happens to be a published poet in our pages, so we were glad to perhaps double dip there. But one of the things that I appreciate about his translation, and one of the things that I think separates it from a lot of translations that have come before, is that very often Ovid adopts a pretty ironic tone toward his material. He's a real jokester. He started his career as a love poet, a poet of amorous affairs, writing books about essentially for pickup artists, you know, how to pick up women, the Ars Amatoria. Books about pining lovers, these poems and poems, kind of creating this tortured poet lover persona, along with a lot of the other amatory poets of his day. But Ovid treats his material often with a lot of humor, and kind of sometimes he'll adopt a sort of tone of mock epic in his Metamorphoses, and a lot of translators, in order to convey that tone, or when you know Ovid slips in something archaizing or you know comical, will just sort of revert to a standard what I call almost a Dryden-esque. So John Dryden was one of the first great translators of Ovid, but the way that Dryden sounded to his audience in the 17th century is not how Dryden sounds to us today, and so when translators kind of reach for this kind of lofty or kind of archaizing style, a lot of times it just sort of gets lost and it gets bogged down in kind of the accumulation of translators sort of borrowing from other translators through the years. So what Charles Martin has done with this translation is render it incredibly fresh, and not to say that he, you know, dips into modern lingo or catchphrases or buzzwords all too much, although there are some very funny passages when he does that. Ultimately, he's more restrained and adopts a much more kind of reasonable baseline level that ultimately gives him much more capacity for variety, for nuance, for various effects throughout the poetry. Because really, it's the range of nuance and voices that make the Metamorphoses such an incredible poem to read. I would say ditto for the translation that we've been using for the Aeneid, Sarah Rudin's translation. When one's translating when one's translating Virgil, it's very easy to get caught up in the grand spirit of empire, of conquest, of city building, of establishment and all this, and lose some of the more somber aspects, the more restrained moments in the text. But what Rudin has done is give, once again, an incredibly fresh translation that doesn't really waste any time, incredibly economic, line-by-line translation, doesn't really waste a lot of time reaching for grand effects, but rather picks a more restrained baseline and then can modulate from that point into other kind of voices and tones and pick up on a lot of the, you know, incredible subtleties that are present in a text like
that. Yeah, it's more plain spoken, I would say, than some of the other translations.
It's plain spoken. It doesn't get lost in this kind of stuffy, again, the Dryden-esque, because people come to the classics and they expect that it should somehow sound, you know, classical.
Yeah, well, that's the challenge, actually, if you just use free online resources to do this, is that you tend to get the Drydens out of copyright, and it can be imposing to work with that alone. So it is worth picking up from the library, from the bookstore, some of these new translations.
It really is. Checking them out. You don't want to be double translating, because if you're having to translate, you know, Dryden's old translation, not that it's not very worthy as a, you know, as a work of poetry in its own right, but to read it, you're translating Ovid twice, because he's already been translated once by Dryden, and then you have to kind of translate it again. So,
well, and I would just say, in terms of, I mean, of course, general cultural knowledge it's an essential reading list that we're doing. It's a basic reading list, really.
I think so. And especially with what we do here at the New Criterion, engaged with culture on so many fronts, in the visual arts, in literature, in architecture, in dance, all of these elements draw so heavily on these classics. And so it's really been fun. We've actually been talking about having a session or two where we just trace out kind of modern resonances from the books that we've been reading.
So, well, you can't look at Renaissance painting, for example, and mythology without reading Ovid and understanding where it's coming from, or Livy or whatever, or the Bible.
Precisely. These things are unintelligible, and so many authors in history. I think Plutarch is a great example of this. Plutarch is not somebody that we really think of today when you think of essentials on the classics reading list. His concerns are thought to be a little out of fashion. He's not really a pure historian, not really even necessarily a pure biographer. He's interested in describing lives, not to find out what motivated a man, or to find out if it's the fact that his mother didn't love him when he was growing up that made him such a nasty fellow once he was, once he was fully grown. He's not so interested in that. So by our own standards of biography, he's doesn't quite fit the bill. But when you look at who was reading Plutarch for, the history of the West, it's an astonishing list. From about the 15th or 16th century onward, maybe a bit later. I mean, all of the major humanists. Erasmus was a great fan of his. Shakespeare lifted whole passages of Antony and Cleopatra from Plutarch. Essentially, the scene when he describes Cleopatra coming in up the Nile on a barge and arriving. Is almost word for word lifted from Plutarch. Ditto for Coriolanus. He was relying heavily on Plutarch's account. So somebody whose hands are really all over what we think of as Western literature and kind of the classical tradition, but isn't always necessarily thought of as being today essential reading. So there's anywhere you look, there are these sorts of opportunities and resonances. And that's part of what's made it all great fun.
Well, and listeners, I would also say that having some wine and cheese while you're doing it helps too.
It doesn't hurt. I would consider it almost an obligation to kind of get the conversation flowing. We've tried some without. It doesn't work nearly as well. Everybody enjoys it much more. And we have better conversation. So
when you're not reading the classics here at New Criterion, Rob might be found on and off Broadway. Rob is the monthly theater critic for The Spectator World Edition. Rob, what are you looking forward to this season?
Sure. Yeah, the rest of this season, we have a few highlights coming up. In terms of, I should mention what we've already seen as well. Back in the fall, Leopoldstadt was an incredible play. It's still running. I think it needs to be seen by anybody who's in New York. There have been some other fun and worthy offerings. One of the great performances that you and I saw together, James, was a play called Between Riverside and Crazy, featuring Stephen McKinley Henderson, who really really commands the stage, playing the role of an aging apartment owner on a rent-controlled apartment, one of the last remaining, really a fine penthouse suite. Up on New York's Upper West Side, and his sort of struggles to win a lawsuit against his former employer, the New York Police Department.
It was really a masterclass of acting.
A masterclass of acting, and he does it all, well, most of it, not even getting up from his chair, just controlling the tempo and pace with his voice and his gesticulations. Really, really impressive stuff. On the horizon. With the recent passing of Stephen Sondheim, there's been a very needed, renewed interest in a lot of his works. We're going to see Sweeney Todd later this spring, which should be excellent. and then recently revived off-Broadway and set to transfer to Broadway for next season was Merrily We Roll Along, which I don't know if I have ever seen a play that is at once both so uplifting and yet such a gut punch, almost sadistic in how viciously, really, Sondheim and his partner in this project, George Firth, sort of dissect this Hollywood career gone wrong of the main character. So both excellent shows. Very much looking forward to seeing
it. And Merrily was Sondheim's famous flop that's now his kind of cult classic.
That's right, cult classic. Merrily We Roll Along was put on off-Broadway by the New York Theater Workshop, featuring Daniel Radcliffe as Charlie Kringis, and then in the star role, Jonathan Groff, a fantastic turn as Franklin Shepard. Those two should be back or expected back next season, so add that to your list of shows to see.
And now, Rob, you are a member of the Outer Critics Circle. Tell us about that organization. Go ahead.
Sure. So the Outer Critics Circle consists of critics who are writing for organizations that are not necessarily focused on theater or not necessarily restricted to New York in their remit, but have maybe more a national audience or of, you know, of a different group of interests. Hence the outer critics. The inner critics would be, you know, the critics at the New York Times are writing for, you know, Broadway.com, these theater focused publications or local publications. But what the outer critics, one of the things that they do that is a sort of highlight of the season, they are the first to release their awards. So awards for all the major categories in plays and musicals on and off Broadway. And one of the interesting stories this year, the Circle just announced, I believe it was a few weeks ago, that they would no longer be considering acting categories separately for the two separate genders, for male and female. This was occasioned, I think, specifically by a performance in a play, Anne Juliet, this year, with a character who does not identify as male or female, nor does the actor playing the character. And so this caught some headlines, a month or so ago when this actor. So the actor decided to remove the actor's own name from consideration for the Tony Awards, if I remember correctly. And it would be easy to sort of see this as the beating drum of identity politics once again, you know, sweeping in like a wave crashing over the world of culture. But on the other hand, I'm not sure it's so straightforward when you think about why separate categories were invented in the first place. It was generally to promote representation of women. So, you know, it's not always a given throughout history that the best actor should be, you know, divided up into two separate roles. So I, for one, will be interested to see the way that this plays out in the theater world. I'm sure there will be, you know, reverberations of this felt well beyond New York among other awards. I can't imagine this issue going away soon, but it will be interesting to see the way that this affects award shows. At the very least, maybe they'll be shorter, which is nice, moving forward.
Yeah, well, I think in one case it did happen with another award program, and there were no women ended up being nominated.
Right.
It didn't work out great.
There will be repercussions. That is for certain. So in a few years we'll be able to get a better handle on what the effects have been, and some of the folks who have been rooting for this change may be regretting their decision. Some of the folks who opposed it may be pretty happy with it. We will see.
Now let's turn back to the Hilton Kramer Fellowship now and your own work as associate editor of the New Criterion. What advice would you offer for aspiring editors and writers?
The best advice I could give for aspiring editors and writers, but both sides really, is to broaden your circle of interest as much as you can. Especially in a place like New York, especially at this particular juncture in your life that you would be in a position to apply for the Hilton Kramer Fellowship. We're looking mostly for recent graduates you know, in their early 20s, you are doing yourself a great favor by not limiting or pigeonholing yourself to one particular beat or one particular interest. And I say this because for writing and editing in general, writing and editing at the New Criterion in particular, we really tend to find that the best writing comes from writers who have an appreciation of both, you know, smaller details and the bigger picture. Writers who can walk through an art exhibition, and this kind of dovetails with some of what we were saying earlier about the importance of classical history for the West. Writers who can walk through an art exhibition and understand not just how, you know, the innovations of a Matisse or a Picasso fit within the scope of the 19th and 20th centuries, but how they fit within the scope of you know, the history of the West, right? And having that experience, that willingness to try covering new topics. I might mention now that I was not, you know, I did not necessarily grow up as a theater kid. I wasn't a drama kid in high school. I came to drama mostly through literature in college, studying not just Shakespeare and you know, more contemporary English playwrights, European playwrights, but also the drama of you know, ancient Greece and Rome. I was not coming to New York expecting to do anything on theater at all, really. I thought it was just sort of a side interest that I had, kind of a passion. And it was working as a Hilton Kramer Fellow at the New Criterion that I was introduced to other people working in the arts, people who had similarly kind of broad-minded views about the way the arts should be approached and written about. And it was, I believe, at the New Criterion Christmas party, in fact, in 2019, that I met Matt McDonald, managing editor at the time at the Spectator World, and, you know, was talking with him about the work that I'd been doing. And he said, hey, well, we're looking for somebody to cover theater. Why don't you take a spin for us?
Well, I think you said it's follow your interests, follow your passion. I think it's good to be a generalist, good to be maybe a focused generalist,
yes,
but be focused on your interests and that let that lead you. And that'll show on the page.
That's right. And don't get caught up in kind of the notions that are really impressed upon you in undergrad about the way a topic needs to be approached seriously. Right. In the academy, approaching a topic seriously, there's generally a positive correlation between seriousness and number of footnotes. Seriousness means, you know, erasing your personal voice from what you're writing and writing in this dry, kind of stuffy academic style. We have a different approach here at the New Criterion. We think that taking a subject seriously and writing seriously about it also means taking your audience seriously, considering your readers before all else. So that's why you won't find our pages stuffed with footnotes, because if it, you know, if it can't be fit into the main thread of your narrative, well maybe it's not, you know, worth the reader's time at all, or at least not for somebody who's reading a monthly publication on the arts. So figuring out how to approach your interests seriously, but with a consideration to your reader. And a consideration, a seriousness that also considers, you know, that subject in its broader context and against the backdrop of the arts.
Well, and I also, as a critic, don't be afraid to learn on the page. I think it's good advice that I was always told.
Yeah, I think that is good advice. Don't be afraid to try on a new voice. Don't be afraid to kind of experiment with your critical approach. One of the wonderful things about the Hilton Kramer Fellowship is that we have, in addition to our print publication, the online wing that we run, Dispatch, where we publish articles on a rolling basis, generally shorter in form, around 1,000 words or so. And as a venue of publication, that is wide open to any Hilton Kramer Fellow who, you know, whatever you are interested in covering. Seriously, whether it's in an art exhibition or, you know, something that you have a passion for. I covered theater in my time as a fellow for the New Criterion on the website, whether it could be book reviews. really, really just finding the chance to try out your voice and to write as much as you can, I think is the key. If given the chance and trying to decide between, you know, covering something that you may not have written on before or that you may not know everything about, given the choice to cover that, a position like the Hilton Kramer Fellowship, I think, really allows a writer to take those risks because you have the support of the editorial team behind you. You're surrounded in an office with folks who are knowledgeable on a wide variety of subjects and can sort of guide you toward resources that you need or sort of perspectives that you should look toward as you craft your work.
Well, and I think also to paraphrase advice from Bill Buckley, William F. Buckley Jr., don't be boring.
Don't be boring.
Rob, I have one more detour. You are from Dallas, Texas, and with that comes a serious commitment to smoking meat. These days, Rob can be found smoking in his backyard in Astoria, New York. Tell us about your setup, Rob. You recently smoked a marvelous pastrami.
That's right. That's right. So, born and raised in Dallas, and as a child of Dallas, I really am a child of the suburbs. Living in Manhattan was just too cramped, too noisy for me. So I moved, first to Brooklyn, but then to Queens, Astoria, Queens, where I have a nice little backyard to myself. And a double chamber offset smoker. The brand is Oklahoma Joe, for those of you who are interested. I don't know if we'll be putting that link in the description as well. But it's been great fun. I try to throw, you know, fire it up once or twice a month. And generally I make as much as I can stuff onto the smoker. So that means there are leftovers. We've had some pastrami, some ribs here in the office, I think, a few other items, some brisket, but all great fun.
What I have to explain, and what many people think is barbecuing, is really grilling. They're grilling on those gas things.
Yes, this is
what you're talking about is something different. It takes many hours.
This is true. So a traditional barbecue, when you think of throwing some charcoals on a circular Weber grill, slapping a grate on top of it, and then turning some burgers into, you know, burned crisps that resemble those pieces of charcoal, or cooking, you know, wonderful burgers. I don't know. But that's grilling, which is a form of barbecue. But there's also another tradition that exists alongside it. That would be smoking meat. That's done low and slow. So at a much lower temperature, and it's done on indirect heat. So for a pastrami, for instance, would be, I think the pastrami that I brought in was 16 pounds before it was cooked. That's about, you know, 12 or 13 hours on the smoker. So it goes on at 4 in the morning and it comes off at 5 in the afternoon when everybody's...
And you have to attend to it that whole time, right?
More skilled smokers than I could be a little more hands-off, but I'm still... still learning the ropes, still have room to improve. So I'm fiddling with the fire every 10 or 15 minutes and wearing myself out. But
and your neighbors in Queens don't mind?
They don't mind as long as I share. The ones who have smoke blowing in their window and don't get any brisket at the end of the day are a little upset.
Well, it's been my pleasure to welcome Rob Erickson, classicist, theater critic, editor, barbecuer, and Hilton Kramer alumnus here today. Listeners, be sure to catch Rob's monthly column in the Spectator World Edition, in addition to his writing for the New Criterion. His weekly recommendations for our own Critics Notebook are always a must-read. For his pastrami, you'll need to join our editorial ranks, maybe as a future Hilton Kramer fellow. I'm James Panero. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, James.